Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Okay. Hello.
So thank you for joining us.
Welcome back to another episode of...
Untalented by Unknown. That was one of the weirdest beginnings of a podcast.
Thank you, Jamie, for joining. I really appreciate it. I've been a huge admirer of Joan for so many years, and I'm so happy that you joined us on this podcast because I think a lot of people are going to want to listen to this one. I want to start... with series two in a slightly different way. Let's talk about this secret talent of yours. What is it?
Oh my God. Okay. I got this late, but I can probably pull something out. So what I want to share with you is when I was in college, I worked at a restaurant called TGI Fridays. Have you heard of it?
Yes, I've heard of that.
Yes, you wear the striped shirts and all the buttons and I used to wear a jester hat. And it was kind of funny because at Fridays, the more you were... I don't know, having fun, the better your tips were.
Right.
So, and it was during, it was 90, at this point, this was 96, and it was right during the 96 Olympics in Atlanta, and I worked in a suburb of Atlanta. I worked at a Fridays. And weirdly, we were slow, so at one point, we were introducing this, they put this new item on the menu called a wrapper. It's a wrap sandwich, but in 96, this was pioneering. It was pioneering, what is this? And I would tell you, we had people from all over the country and all over the world come in and they would say, what is this wrapper? And so I was bored. I had one shift. It was kind of slow. And so I just started writing a rap, which is terrible and really super cringy. And if any,
Do you still remember it?
I do.
Oh.
I do because I did it all summer long because my boss said, if you do it, every time you do it at the table, I will buy you dinner. So as a poor college kid, I was like, hell yeah, I will keep doing this all the time. So I remember it. So it was a wrap. There were wrapper sandwiches. Again, just a wrap sandwich, but very novel. And so people would be like, excuse me, do you want to know what a wrapper is? Here, can you tell me what these wrappers are? So go ahead, ask me.
What's a wrapper sandwich?
Oh, you want to know what a wrapper is?
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
I keep doing this on a podcast. You want to know what a wrapper is? Wrap, 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 wrap. Well, we got a veggie wrapper and we got a Philly cheese. We got grilled chicken. We got everything you please. They all look real nice. They're the perfect size. I ain't telling you lies. Man, they all come with fries. First, we take a pita and we stuff it real fat. You know it tastes good because Fridays is all that. You'll never find another because in life this will be here, zero. It's kind of like a hoagie and it's kind of like a gyro. So when you're wondering what to order, just hear my voice. Go for the wrapper. It's the perfect choice. Wrap, 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 wrap. That's what I did.
Oh, that's
and
amazing.
Honestly, I don't know. I think it's probably going to be the thing where from now, I'm going to call you. I'm going to say, please cut that out.
No, we're keeping that in 100%. That's going to go viral.
Oh no, God. Please. That's my worst.
That's so great.
Unless it goes viral and Fridays wants to hire us. Then I would be like, okay.
You didn't eat. You didn't have to pay for another meal for the.
No, I literally did it every single day. And I got lunch or dinner every single day.
God, the customers must have loved that.
I don't know.
No.
Maybe.
Yeah, I would have been confidence. Sure.
You're like, I will order this. We sold a lot of wrappers. We did. We sold a lot of wrapper sandwiches.
You know, it might be a nice segue into the first part of this podcast. Were you getting your creative kind of writing flowing then? Was that part of it? And then, I don't know, I want to hear is that when a creative director was eating at TGI Fridays, they picked up on your writing style from this rap and then you got in? How did you get in?
Oh, that would have been a real movie. Oh my God, it's, Jeff Goodby is at TGI Fridays. He's like, we've got to hire this girl. I've always loved to write things and I love fun, silly things. Yeah. But actually, I kind of was interested in advertising from even a really young age. I saw a movie. And the movie had a character in it who was an advertising agency woman. And I thought, okay, that's really, it looks cool.
Yeah.
You know, she was a business lady, but she was also creative. And I think there was probably some juggling involved. And so it felt like that's a cool career. And then strangely enough, in high school, I had a friend who was kind of this cool girl with Doc Martens. And she did this club called, this is going to sound so crazy, but it was a marketing club. It was called DECA. And it was all about a marketing competition. And one of the things was broadcast advertising. So I started doing that. And I won in New York State 2 years in a row. Felt pretty cool.
Yeah.
So I've always sort of wanted to, but I didn't know really that it was, I didn't really know much about the career path. I went to a regular 4-year college, English major, creative writing minor. Hoped to be in advertising, but not really knowing much about it. And then just got lucky and got a first job.
Where was that? And then I want to know the short version of your career up to Joan, because we want to talk about Joan. Like, what got you to the point where you decided to set up Joan?
So first job was at a place called Mad Dogs and Englishmen in New York, and it was wonderful. It was amazing. It was a family. Everybody that was around in the New York ad scene, you know, at that time still remembers it fondly. And we talk about it, like, when I tell people that are like a little bit older, you know, in advertising, those at Mad Dogs are like, oh my God. And then they all were either in Mad Dogs, had come, like, had interned there, whatever. Liz Taylor from Ogilvy and I were just talking. She was at Mad Dogs for a few months. Wow. Yeah. So it's kind of like a crazy thing.
Like an incubator for the future.
Chris Beresford Hill, Dan Lucy, like my husband James Robinson. Yeah, like so many people went through Mad Dogs and Englishmen. And so that was kind of a crazy thing, but learned the value of being creative, about being edgy, about using mediums in a different way. Then went to, do you want me to keep going on my journey?
Keep going.
Then I went to Shiat in San Francisco. And was working on things like Adidas and Fox Sports. Ray-Ban launched the Never Hide campaign. Was there working for a guy named Chuck McBride, amazing, stellar creative. And then wanted to learn digital. So I went to an agency called Evolution Bureau for a couple years.
Okay.
And
that one did, like, when was that?
2006, I think, is what it was. And we were just, it seemed like people were talking a lot about it. Yeah. It was just getting interesting. We did a whole bunch of really great work that, you know, won a bunch of DNAD pencils. And it was one of those things that I was like, for the first time, I'm like, oh my God, I don't just have to go one way.
Yeah.
Like, I can put my work out there and people can actually engage in a conversation with me. And I found, like, that I really valued what audiences think about things and how much creativity other people have in them. So that was so fun. And then I went to Pierre Dodel. And was there for many, many years. And then went to Wieden for a little bit and then went to, and then opened Joan.
So, I mean, Pierre Dodel and then Wieden's up to Joan, setting up your own thing. What made you do that move? Like, to, what was the kind of straw that broke the camel's back to do Joan?
Well, I you know, when working at Pierre Dodel, I was there from the very, very start. And also Mad Dogs was small. And I was like watching a lot of these founders build a culture, build the kind of work that they want to do, create a community. And I was like, this is so freaking fun. Mm. I mean, even Shiat in San Francisco was obviously part of Shiat Day and obviously part of a holding company, but operated as this weird little island that they just, it was its own weird little culture. And the, I think the real thing that put it over the edge for me was working with PJ and Andrew and working for them and watching them have a vision and bring it to life and being there in those early stages of, and even when I left, I'd been there for almost 8 years and it was still like the rules could be invented as we went along. Nothing was codified. There were obviously we had systems in place, but we could still improve it and change it. And that was so fun.
Yeah.
So I kind of knew that. And then I was sitting there looking around and it was 2015 and I'm like, well, kind of seems like there are, you know, there's a big moment for women. And it kind of felt like there were not really many ad agencies founded by women. And I also fell in love with the idea of creating really, really great creative work for women audiences. Because my whole life as a creative, I had just always been, you know, fighting for the guys' briefs because they were the more interesting ones and the girls' ones were going to be really boring. So so I was like, it's time to fucking take a stand and make better work for women. So that I've started to launch Joan. I actually had a client almost right after leaving Wieden, actually immediately after leaving Wieden, and then started working on that business and then grew that business and then met Lisa. And then we officially made Joan because it wasn't Joan after kind of coming together a few months later and really making it happen.
Wow. That's so cool. And I have huge admiration for you for doing that as well at that point in time. Very much needed. And I think you've set the kind of path for other female creative leaders as well, truly, who certainly I've spoken to. I want to know about your previous places like Pierre Dodel, like, and Wieden's, the systems and the things that you learned that you then took to Joan, like, and principles, I guess. Like, how did you founded Joan? Like, what did you have in place apart from, like, making killer creative work that championed women as well?
I think it's all about trying to create a space where people are excited to come and bring their best creative work and their best creative energy.
Yeah.
I think that that was a really important thing. And all of the companies that I had been at, I was lucky enough to be at places that had cultures like Mad Dogs, where they spawned these other greats. You know, if I think about, you know, if I can tell you the people that came out of this tiny little office of Shy at San Francisco, your mind would be blown. It was just really just yeah. some of the greatest CCOs in America now. And then the same thing at Pereira Nodel. So many great CCOs were kind of born from that. And I think it wasn't an accident. It was because all of these people that ran it took time to say, like, let's make creativity at the forefront. Let's create an environment where you can bring ideas and we get excited about each other's ideas.
Yeah.
It's not just about, you know, my ideas or you know, one star team's ideas. Mm. Like, let's see where the ideas can come from. And if it's an intern or a strategist or an account person or the client, and it's a great fucking idea, let's get excited yeah. about that. So that was always a really important thing for me. And you know, there are times in where I worked at places where that wasn't quite the case. Mm. And there are times there was, and it was something that I really wanted to really make sure that was yeah. in part of a Jones culture. And then I think the other things that I learned about was a commitment to keeping pushing things yeah. like, you know, and I know it can be very frustrating sometimes, but like, if it's not out the door, it's not done yet. Mm. And you can keep making it better. I always have this thing. It's never too late to do the right thing. Yeah. If like you can make something fucking better, try to push for it. And I mean, I know we're working with tighter timelines and less budgets, but you know, in this day and age in 2025, but I still believe it. Like
yeah.
keep pushing it. If you love it, push it to make it better.
Definitely. Like that's a strong core principle, I can yeah, tell. Like
absolutely.
The work as
oh,
well.
Thanks. Thank you.
For sure. No,
thank
I see
you.
It.
Probably because also they drive everybody else nuts. I'm like, and it was supposed to end. I'm like, no, we have to keep going. We have to keep going. It's not perfect yet.
But it's high standard as well, isn't yeah. it? You care for the work. Yeah, and I think yeah. that's such a, it's the perfect trait for a creative leader. I would love to know like the work that kind of put Joan on the map as
yeah,
well. So like really in the early days. And also, talk about like the change since 2015 through to 2025. Geez, like
I know
we're going to come on to what you've been doing in Europe yeah. as well. But like, yeah. what was the stuff that put you on the map originally?
Well,
then
we were so fortunate to win General Mills, five brands from General Mills in right as we opened. Wow. It was the work that I was working on before actually Joan was official. But then when they put it into pitch, they put it to a big review across the country, and I and Lisa and I with a team of people pitched and we won five brands. So that was crazy exciting. And like right away, like, you know, doing work for Progresso Soup, which is, you know, kind of a fun brand and a very legendary brand and maybe a brand that you don't think about very often as like this crazy rock and roll agency's coming out. They're going to do Progresso Soup. But we were actually, the client was so awesome that we did work. We did writing that was actually really outrageous. And and I still to this day look back and go, I can't believe we got away with that. And the voiceover was done by John Lithgow and yeah. it was so fun. It was like insane. I think the very first thing that made people go, oh, that's interesting, was we did a piece for Netflix, which was called Rules for the Modern Woman. And we were given a call from them a couple of days before the Emmys. And they said, we really want to create a piece that will live in social, a video that will live in social. Because we have this campaign and it's like, it's called She Rules. And we made a really splashy TV spot for it, but we want to do something in social that's a little bit more edgy. We're like, okay, cool. So that, but you have to use the hashtag She Rules.
Right.
So we're like, okay, we have to use rules, but we don't want to be like, yay, She Rules. And so we were like, what are we going to do? Well, we were talking about all the rules that are placed on women. And we made this kind of spoof about an old Emily Post ad, you know, old Emily Post film, like, you know, the old etiquette. Like a lady always knows which silverware to use. A lady always lets her guests eat before her. But then we took all of those and we put it up against footage of Netflix female characters being incredibly yeah. violent, inappropriate, funny, disgusting, you know, not acting like ladies. Yeah. And the juxtaposition was really funny. And we yeah. were able to do this really quick. I mean, it was a clip spot, so it was very fast to make, 3 days, just pulling footage around the clock. In the end, I remember we were in the Emmys was on Sunday. We were in the edit on Friday. And I was like, oh, we don't have, oh, we've pushed it faster. We've pushed it closer okay. to the line than that. Yeah. Sam's face was like, what? That's, please, we've done more tight squeezes than that. But my producer was like, oh, by the way, Jamie, you're going to be the voiceover for it. Because you're here. And I'm like, what? Okay. You know, and so.
Have you done any voiceovers before?
I mean, like, well, not really, but like, I don't know, scratch tracks, you know. But I'm like, okay, I guess we're going to do that. And that was it. And it made quite a splash. It was like Netflix's highest performing social post ever at the time. Amazing. And so it was really fun. So yeah, so that was super exciting.
I think that shows a real diversity in the way that you and your colleagues can think, right? And your peers can think, rather than just big brand platform. It's like, this is slightly different, especially back in, was it 2015, 2016?
Yeah. Kind of, oh yeah.
That was, these days it's slightly different. A lot of, I can imagine those briefs are quite common, but back then it's slightly different, you know?
Yeah.
Kind of really pushed it.
And to be at speed, you know, to work at speed. Joan is extremely comfortable with working at speed.
Yeah.
Extremely comfortable. We don't complain about timelines. We are excited. Sometimes we think our best ideas can come faster.
Yeah.
And I think we're really good at making things very quickly, which is actually, you know, we've started to do a lot more in social and influencer, and it's something that you can see that actually really having an advantageous effect there, because you got to move fast, you know. And then, you know, it's so funny because right after that, you mentioned the diversity. The next piece after that we did was an experiential piece for Adidas. We did a whole women's running event in Los Angeles and created a runnable museum of like women's accomplishments.
I love that.
And it was like wild. Yeah. It was like, but that was, think about how different that is from like, you know, a big TV campaign for a very traditional legacy brand to a crazy fast turn social thing to an experiential piece all in the space of like 5 months. It was kind of nuts.
Was the media already there, or was it, did you come, was it a solution to a creative problem, or create a solution to a problem that they have?
Create a solution to a problem that they have. Yeah. We wanted to really kind of start doing more grassroots things with women for the experiential piece and getting women to try on the new shoes. Awesome. So we thought, okay, let's do an experience with them.
And that's amazing. Cool. Yeah. Again, diversity of thought, like that's amazing. Like not just pure ads, which you've done plenty of wonderful ones. I'm curious about the first kind of 3-4 years then at Joan.
Yeah.
What were the kind of leadership lessons and growing of a team, and what were the kind of top things that you learned you hadn't before joining or launching?
Well, I think probably between year one and year, you know, three is quite a leap. I think year one, things came extremely easy to us.
Really?
Oh yeah. I mean, we were a small crew. Mm. And we're lucky to have won so much business. We were lucky that the timing of our announcement was really kind of coinciding with the zeitgeist. I think for me as a creative leader, and it's a lesson I'm still learning, is really learning to give people space. And it's hard when you come up, when we were in our first couple of years, literally everything that came out, I was hand building. Do you know what I mean? I was probably the copywriter on it, not just the CD, not just the ECD or the CCO. I was also probably the junior copywriter, writing the social posts, like that kind of crap, you know? And so I think for me, it was really hard to kind of, and I'm just being very open and honest, but it's to like start to let other people have room.
Yeah.
But it's critical. And I think we don't do a lot of teaching our leaders how to make those switches, you know? And I think we learn it in the framework of a traditional agency structure when you're not a founder, but barely. I mean, you kind of do it by, you know, trial and error. And I think we as an industry have to be much better at being like, hey, this is what happens when you go from being a person who's a doer to being a person who's a doer / overseer to now being a person who's just an overseer to now being someone who just sets the vision and doesn't even oversee. And we have to do better at that.
Yeah.
But I'll say as a founder, I found it particularly hard because you're just like, oh my God, like literally, you know, many people don't realize how much your personal everything, your life, your finances, your I don't know, even your identity gets tied up in what comes out.
Yeah, totally.
And so you start to, you know, if you're not careful, you can white knuckle. And I think probably I've had a couple moments of that in my time, you know, and I'm just learning to be a little bit more open to things. Yeah. And I think one thing that I'm finding really exciting now is I'm so excited by other people's creativity more than mine. I'm like, that's fucking awesome. Like, I cannot believe I have one team doing something amazing right now. And it's completely something that they came up with and proactively pitched. And it's wonderful. And it's the best solution for this client. It's going to be so cool.
And your job is to make sure that it's sold in to the client.
That's my job. My job is like, what do you need? Well, what do you need? And actually they did a great job of selling it in. They did all, I mean, and it's just, and like, yeah, just being like, I'll give you all the space, you know, if you need any kind of, you know, hours or money, whatever, we can get that going. And it's been tremendous.
How do you, I mean, I feel that as well. How do you make sure that they are protected and give them that space when there are tight deadlines and things like that?
This is the question that
it might be a million-dollar question.
I mean, it's probably like the $500 billion question. However much the whole industry spends, and it's something that I think everybody's really struggling with across the board, no matter how big you are, whether you're a giant holding company agency or a small independent. I think everybody's trying to figure this out. And I, you know, there used to be more padding and room in both, you know, schedules and budgets.
Yeah.
I think the thing to do, and also interestingly, there used to be, I think, more appetite for people to literally pull all nighters or work all weekend than there is now. And maybe that's healthy. Maybe that's okay. But like used to be like, okay, yeah, no, the day is like really like a, the days like really can be like a 22-hour day. Like really, if you, you know, back when I was a kid, I mean, I can't tell you how many all-nighters I pulled up trying to like crack the brief so I didn't have to walk into my creative director's thing or empty-handed. But I think that you just have to try your best to systematize it. And I'm saying that completely full of shit because it is not systematized at Joan at all. But we want to systematize it and say like, okay, if you're on it for this amount of something for this amount of time, you get like 2 days to explore something different. You
know, yeah.
That kind of a thing.
Wow. So I'm curious about the next stage for Joan then. Like, let's talk about let's talk about the work as well. Like what work since, you know, starting Joan, like part of the Adidas piece, the Netflix piece, the last 5 years, particularly post, like during the pandemic, how did that affect you guys? And
oh my gosh.
What have you gotten off the back of it?
I think there was a period of really safe work that everybody had during the pandemic, and for a good reason. The world is going completely chaos.
Yeah.
And I think we went through, we for Lisa and I, it was really important that we didn't fire anybody during the pandemic. We didn't want to let anybody go because we knew it was going to be so hard to get a job during the pandemic. So, you know, we took on a lot of things, maybe things that we wouldn't normally have taken on. But we just wanted to make sure that the team was secure and that we didn't have to, which I'm so proud of us. We didn't.
So you didn't,
let anybody go.
Wow.
During COVID. None. Yeah. It was something that was really important, and everybody chipped in, dug it deep, and, you know, people are what your business is, so you want to make sure you take care of the responsibility of being a founder is you feel it. You feel people's, you know, lives are intertwined with yours.
Yeah.
So, but I will say, even that we did win a couple clients just immediately after the pandemic, and that were, you know, doing really interesting things. I think, you know, we've done some really fun work for clients that are like, Black Forest gummies was this, and it's not, this is work that's not even on our site anymore, which I'm like, oh, maybe I need to make a second site, which is just like, we miss you. we love this work. But we did this thing for Black Forest gummies. They're all natural gummy, and their gummy is like super juicy. And so we created a fake place that, and their biggest competitor is Haribo.
Right.
And they get like 90% of they get so much of the sale, the shelf space. And so we were like, we have to get people to look for Black Forest gummy specifically. We have to make them think it's really fun and also natural. So we created a fake place, a fake world, country, a nation, where gummies grow on trees and people harvest them. And we created this whole culture around it. And we made this really super charming, you know, series of films about it, like spots.
Yeah.
But what I loved about it was we actually played like it was a real place. And so what we did was we didn't launch it with the spots. We launched it by having travel influencers. We got on board 3 travel influencers before we launched to come to our set during the shoot, take photographs as if it was really a place that they discovered. And then we had like Lonely Planet did a guide to visiting the Black Forest. We actually had a cultural exchange where the fat Black Forest people brought a tree to New York City. They didn't bring the set delivery. They brought a gummy tree, and there was a harvest on the High Line. So we did all of these crazy things, like totally straight, kind of Andy Kaufman-esque. No, it's a real place. Like even the press release was like, we discovered this land of the Black Forest. It was this. It was like,
who would have thought it in New York?
Who would have thought, right? So I really love that.
I can we put that back on the site?
I know. It was so fun.
The work that we made, but is not on our site. I love that. That's cool. Did you do activations and stuff off the back of that?
So the Culture Exchange was an activation.
Yeah.
That was an activation. They, like, we had street teams handing out, like, people all dressed in the costumes of the Black Forest. They were, like, really skimpy lederhosen. It was really funny. It was really funny. But they were handing out. They did gummy harvest on the hour. We did a ton of shopper for that. That was actually really fun, I thought. Yeah. Like, I think sometimes, like, you take the mediums that you can't, that, like, you think are boring, like couponing.
Mm. Yeah.
Sampling. Send somebody in a Black Forest outfit to go to do the sampling in a store. So that was really fun.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Oh, wicked. I had so many questions about this, but, like, also content is another thing that all brands are raving about and, you know, really focusing heavily on as well. And just this point in time where you set up Joan in 2015 through to now, like, are you just getting more, can you just make us an amazing piece of content rather than a brand platform all the time? Like, how often are those conversations coming up?
So
what are brands asking for as well?
Most of our brands were AOR for,
right.
But we also make content
right.
For them. And we do through Joan Studios, we have an incredible content team. We have an influencer team and a social team, and there are tons of makers in Joan Studios. So Joan has got two companies. It's Joan Creative and then Joan Studios.
And you got Joan Design, haven't you?
And then Joan Design, that's part of Joan Creative. And then Joan Media, which is our joint venture with Cross Media. So in Joan Studios, we have a really incredible team. I mean, unbelievable team of content makers. And we do some influencer there too, and social. We will get briefs that, and if they're interesting to us, we'll take them and say, yeah, we'll go ahead and do a project.
Yeah.
Most of our clients are AOR though.
That's really interesting. Yeah. Okay. That's really cool. So, fast forward to like the last couple of years, cause you set up in the UK 2 years ago, didn't you?
2020. We did.
Yeah. And now you're in Berlin
as
well. How's that been launching in another continent?
It's crazy. You have to find also this, it's the same thing. You have to find the place of, you know, setting the goals and setting the vision with them or working with them to set the vision, but letting them do it in their own markets the way they would. Using your might when you can. And certainly for global pitches and global things, we are all operating as a unit, global clients and global pitches. The thing that I think is really was so exciting was, and I'll take London as an example. So we set up London. We had hired Kirsty, our executive creative director out there. She's the best, right?
Superstar, love her.
She is the best. I don't mean to get like so, I just love this woman so much.
She is brilliant. And actually, I think she's amazing. What a great hire.
Oh, yay. so we had hired her and then we found her an MD partner in Tom Guyton, who is also amazing, great. Unbelievable. But it was really fun because Lisa and I had gone out there when they first got those guys together and they were working together for a few months and they said, we want you to come out let's come out. We did an offsite there. And they took us through the deck, their deck of what Joan London was. And it felt so exciting to see the Joan brand, the Joan ethos and Joan philosophy that like Lisa and I had worked so many years to kind of set up, but reinterpreted for London and with the flavor and the spice of an agency, of an office that's at their, you know, at their life stage. Because it was like falling in love again.
Really?
Not that I'd ever fallen out of love with it, but like, it was like seeing, when you see, you know, when if you're with a partner for a long time and like, suddenly they put on like a, you know, they cut their hair or whatever, and you're like, wow, I think you're cute. That was what it was. It was like, wow, fuck, that is so cool.
Yeah.
It gave us actually some energy to bring back to the New York office at the time. And I think that's what can happen when you have different offices and you have the beginning of essentially our own network is that each office can inspire, push, educate the other offices. One thing that Kirsty is brilliant at is PR. So she'd come up through publishing and she is the kind of person that's like, I'll just make the phone call myself. I'm just gonna do this. And like, okay, no. It's like, we have to get this more coverage and I'm gonna do this and that and make this thing. And so have her come and like teach the New York office. Like, how do you do this? How do you get them work out more? Like what are the tricks that she's known from her previous career?
Wow.
So it's pretty cool.
So can I ask what inspired you setting up an office in London as well?
A couple of things. Like I think Lisa and I always felt that we would love for Joan to go beyond the New York office, but we didn't know at the time, should we set up in LA and do more entertainment, which could come at some point, who knows? Should we go and set up, you know, maybe like we know that, you know, they're really design heavy in Latin America. Like, do we do something down there? But I think we had started thinking about Europe feels like a nice next space for us. We had a few clients that were interested in a European offering of Joan, great. Which was exciting.
Really cool.
And so it was like, okay, this could be the ticket to do it. We looked in Amsterdam and we looked in London. And we decided for the sake of where some of our clients were located to do London. However, I will also say that my husband is English. And so yeah, that didn't hurt. My children are dual citizens. So that did not hurt. So it was a good thing. But
They got family over there type of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
We can, that makes sense.
We can go out and like, you know, I don't know, maybe go stay there for a little bit.
Yeah. Oh, okay. I like that. I didn't know that. That also makes sense. And knowing Joan, I kind of understand the background behind some of the clients as well. And also you landed hot and you grew the team really superbly. You've got some very, very good hires there. I don't know much about Berlin though. What put that on? Because that's super creative city in itself.
Yeah, like, it is.
What inspired that one?
So we also had clients that were asking for it.
Okay.
And then on top of that, I think that there is, your point about it being a super creative city is really interesting to Lisa and I. So London also, I will say, going back to London, obviously massively creative city, but also like the birthplace of punk rock.
Yeah.
Maybe in Westwood. It felt Joan-y in a way, you know? I think Berlin, what I was surprised to see is how connected creative people are in Berlin to one another.
Yeah.
The team out there is really connected to some of the most interesting, artists, designers, musicians, makers out in Berlin. And I think it's something interesting about having access to that cultural talent as well. So that was the hope.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I think I've always got the impression of friends and you know, creatives that I've spoken to, designers that I've spoken to there. It's a very nomadic city. People, you know, I think it's truly diverse as well. And you've got people from all walks of life that go to Berlin, fill that creative scene. So I can imagine how tremendous that would be for creative ideas and ideation as well.
We're in the business of bringing new into our pool of thinking.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you stay in one place or in one box or in one type of creative voice or one type of creative idea, and you don't open yourself up, you severely limit the way you can combine the different Lego bricks in your mind to make an idea.
Yeah.
And so what we look for is diversity always of talent, whether that is like who they are diverse, the diversity of background, the diversity of their creative taste, their diversity of their skill set. We want diversity in as many ways as possible. We have people in our office that have been client side. We've had people in our office that have been on the entertainment side for real entertainment, publishing, all these different places. And so opening in Berlin and opening in London allowed us access to so much new talent. It was really cool.
That's so cool. I didn't ask, like, where does the name Joan come from? Like, what's the story there? I should have asked that at the beginning of this.
No. So when Lisa and I were starting, we had a choice, obviously, to name ourselves. It's the fun thing that founders get to do, right? Like, you know, you have to also like read tax code and LLC formation and all that shit. But you get to pick a name. And for me, a brand has always been in some ways a story. And an agency brand is also a story. And so we wanted to tell a story with our name. And it sort of came to me in a flash one night. I was just thinking about it. And I was thinking about the conversations that Lisa and I had had and talking about the people that inspired us and the kind of people we wanted to be or leaders within the in the industry wanted to be. And we wanted our people to be and our clients to be. And a lot of the inspiration that we were having was the name, were people that were named Joan.
Wow.
Yeah, it was like, you know, it was like Joan Rivers. And she was this foul-mouthed, funny comedian. And she just said what her experience was like.
Amazing.
And and everybody loved the comedy. She wasn't doing it for just women. She was doing it for men and women. But she made jokes that were like, women could be like, oh yeah, fucking get that.
Yeah.
I fucking get that. And Joan Jett, she was obviously like this amazing rock and roller, like total punk. And like, you know, and we actually had her at the office a couple times early on and she was so nice.
Yeah.
So cool. And then, you know, Joan of Arc, of course, yeah. Joan Armatrading, Joan Collins. Yeah. Like, obviously, we love the fact that yeah. there was like some diamonds in there. Yeah. Joan Didion, Joan Baez, wow. Joan Miró, the godfather of surrealism. So you had all of these Joans, and it was like, oh, that's a name that means something, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it's funny because when we launched, like, people were like writing to us, and they were like, oh my God, yeah. my wrestling coach in high school, her name was Joan and she didn't take shit from anybody.
I love that.
Or my aunt, her name is Joan and she's the funniest and like the hardest ass woman. Or someone said, I had a 1984 like Cutlass Sierra that was brown and we called it Joan. And I was like, or something like that, like some kind of like old car called it Joan. And I'm like, yes, okay. So that does mean something. It means something.
I love that. I never knew that. I mean, that makes so much sense as well. That's phenomenal. Let's talk about the future then. Where do you want Joan to get to? You've touched all different parts of the creative process and, you know, the diverse storytelling piece is truly there as well. I mean, with storytelling in its own, I'm going to talk to you about that in a second and the importance of that. But like, where does Joan, where's that in the next 2-3 years for you?
I think we're going to keep building on the kinds of work we put out and pushing ourselves creatively. I think that's going to be a big thing, is pushing ourselves creatively.
What does that look like, if you don't mind me asking? Does that mean like more awards? That
could be
deeper relationships.
It could be. To be honest with you, I mean, I love awards. I think they're great, and I want to see us win them. But I want to see us win them for the fact that our work is the best in class, and that also mostly audiences loved our work. I'm not interested in us winning awards for things that four people saw, and you know that's not cool. So I think that for us, you know, if we're doing work that we love and the world loves it, especially the audiences that we're creating for love it, then I'm pretty pumped. I think awards are important because I think if nothing else, they help the people's careers that work for us. You know, I can tell you like the first time I won a Grand Prix, I was like, oh, okay. Like I can walk into any room now, you know, and that was pretty cool.
Does it help with brands as well?
Some brands are very interested in it.
Yeah.
Some couldn't care less.
Yeah.
And so I think you're at a place where it's, I don't know, some, you know?
Yeah, interesting. Because I always get that impression, especially when you're in like the likes of Cannes and there's all the massive brands out there and like loads of ridiculous amount of cash kind of floating around. It's like nuts. I mean, it's amazing, but it's kind of crazy at the same time.
Everybody wants to win in Cannes. Yeah. Talk to everybody in December, you know, when they're trying, then they're looking at their year-end numbers, you know, and they're like, well, let's, you know. But I do think they are... I think that they are, when we are an industry that is putting out work that is capable of winning awards, we're an industry that has swagger.
Yes.
And I love that. And I want that for my people. I want them to have like this, you know, I don't want to have to fight to keep them, but I actually want to also have to fight to keep them.
Yeah.
You know? So that's it. I think also pushing into, I have an obsession with the new. Yeah. I have an absolute obsession with the new. And I want to keep pushing into things that were never done before, or we didn't think could be done, or building new capabilities, or trying new things. Like I love it when our team has an idea, and then the producers are like, oh, "I don't know how to do that. Like, what is even?" I love when we come up with an idea that if you tried to enter into an award show, you wouldn't know what category it would go in. Like, what even category is this in?
Yeah,
like that is what's exciting. And so, being addicted to the new is something that I feel, you know, I want us to keep having and even putting like up to the next fold at Joan. And it's because it's what's effective for clients, right? You can't, we as a species are evolutionarily trained to notice anomalies out in the world, right? We're on the Serengeti back as prehistoric man. We're watching and the grass is going like this. And suddenly the grass goes like this and we pay attention because something could be there to eat us. So what we need to do is, and so our bodies still react that way.
Yeah.
So what we need to do is make the grass go like this, but then not be there to eat them. Be there to like tell them about a really awesome product or brand that they need to know about. But you know, you have to make that grass go like that in order to get people's attention.
Wow. No, that makes so much sense. I love that. I love a good analogy, and that's a bloody good one, I must admit. We've touched upon this a little bit in the session, this podcast already, about how you run and lead your team.
Yeah.
Kind of, because I sense there's a lot of empathy in there as well, and that you really care about your team. But like, how would you describe that, your leadership style?
Oof. You know, someone asked us that when I first started, and I don't even have a good enough answer. But I'll tell you what I think it is. I think my leadership style is evolving to trying to give space to people, give clear directives and like clear goals.
Yeah.
Then give space, but then when it's needed to inject energy. I think one thing that I'll just say something nice about myself, because I've obviously said some things where I'm like, oh, I haven't gotten that right yet. But one thing I'm really good at is when there needs to be energy around something or in a room, I am pretty good at bringing it.
Yeah.
And I think it's a little bit like also like, you know, the founder walks in and has something nice to say or brings in some energy.
Yeah, energy.
But, you know, it's anybody could do that, but I feel like it's something that I'm pretty good at.
Yeah.
So what I feel like is on the converse side, though, when the energy is bad, you have to be careful of that too. But but I think that leadership style of like really getting excited about other people's victories and encouraging them to push farther. That's it. Because you can't just be excited. You have to like, okay, now what's next? Like, where do we go? How do we push into new territory? How do we actually take it and make it bigger? How do we move that football further down the field? How do you make it more true or more emotional or more impactful or more? Like it has to be whatever you do, you have to commit fully to the bit.
Yeah.
And so just really getting people to see that and have the bravery to go and push that far and also help them with the stamina. And that's where the energy comes in. Because I think people get to a point where they're like, yeah, that's good. And they lose their energy.
Yes.
And then you have to go, okay, no. I see you. I believe in you. I know you can make this stronger. Push it further.
Yeah. Wow. I love that. I mean, I can imagine any junior, midweight, senior, even CD level working into you truly would find your energy infectious and want to continue to push. Do you have a question around it comes to talent? Like, can you tell when someone's like got it? Or like, what are there certain traits that and consistencies that you see in talent which you just know, okay, they've got that kind of grit or, you know, they've got the curiosity to become great. Like, what are their consistencies there, would you say?
I think first is a very basic human trait, which is tenacity and resilience. Like those two, if you have those two traits, you're already like way ahead of everybody else because you're going to get knocked down. Like you're going to get punched in the face, kicked in the nuts so many times as a creative, like you just have to keep getting back up and you have to want it. You have to want it. Like you have to want it.
Yeah.
And you have to get excited about ideas. Mm. I think the people that really succeed are the people that are not afraid to be, put themselves out there and to be a little silly or say something that is maybe not right or maybe weird or whatever and just go for it. So I think that those, tenacity, you know, fearlessness and resilience are the three top ones.
Yeah.
I think as far as work goes, I always look for somebody who helps reframe something in my mind that I didn't see it that way. Like if you're like, wow, I didn't even notice that, but I should have.
Yeah.
Or I didn't think of it that way, but I should have.
Yeah.
Or on the other side, whoa, I would never have thought of that.
Yeah.
And I don't even know if it's right, but I am so intrigued. Right. Yeah. Like I want to see more from you. Yeah. I want to know what the brain does. And I think with all of the shit, with all the AI, which I love AI, I really do. I mean, I use Claude every day. I love it. But like with all of that, that originality, that tenacity, that resilience will be the thing that will never go away. It's so funny. I was thinking about this the other day. I was like, as we think about AI, really making it that everybody is on the same level. We all have access to the same level of smarts.
Yeah.
Right? We all have access to the same level of research and data and even processing of that data and even analysis of that data, right? We can all go to Claude or ChatGPT and analyze data.
Yeah.
So we're all going to be smart, right? And we're all going to have an abundance of ideas that we can pull from.
Yeah.
What are going to be the things that differentiate us? And truly it is the things that make us most human, right? It's going to be the people that like the eyes to see something and go, that's right, you know, and to know that that is something that is the right idea. It's going to be the heart with the passion to be able to say, I believe in it so much that I'm going to follow it. It's going to be the stomach to say, I'm going to put something on the line, you know? And I also think it's going to be the literal body. So I don't think we ever have to worry about being replaced by AI because we're the only ones that have, for now, at least, a body.
Yeah.
To go and move and do something and make things happen and convince other people.
Yeah. So, are you finding more brands are asking for that as well? Like, how are you...
AI?
Yeah. Like, how are we incorporating... Like, is it not really kind of a...
I don't think so. I mean, everyone... I've had brands ask for some kind of an interesting creative piece that uses AI.
Right. Yeah.
But I haven't seen brands saying, you have to use AI in your process. I think that, to be honest, I don't think brands and clients will care as long as you're bringing down the cost somehow. Mm-hmm. I think agencies care because that's how they're going to bring down the costs.
Yeah.
And so I'm not sure how much they're interested in it. What I'm curious about is how can you use AI to tell stories in a way that nobody's ever told stories before?
How could they do that? How could AI do that?
I mean, imagine this. This is a nascent idea, but like, imagine a story that is written and it's different for everybody, and the prompts are what's written by the author. Not the story itself. The story is written by ChatGPT or Claude, but the prompts are written by the author. Yeah. So you follow the story. The story is created with you as you prompt. And maybe we leave interesting places for the audience to interject. I mean, I'm fucking spinning this up right now as we speak, but maybe you leave audience in ways for interject, and that becomes a different story for them in that way.
Yeah.
And so I think that there's different ways that you can use things that make experiences that materialize before your eyes. I mean, that's the magic of it, right? You sit down, you plug something in, and something materializes before your eyes. It's fully magic.
Yeah, I feel like it's gotten everybody to the same level, and it's almost like leveled the playing field out, and also going to unfortunately cut some people out because some people might not be able to keep up with it.
Well, and my advice to young people would be, get really good at curation as fast as you can.
Okay,
because the jobs that, you know, that could be replaced are the ones that are like the people that have to write 600 taglines in order to find the one. Yeah. Right. So be the person who's getting used to being a creative director and use the AI in a way that is a creative director would, how a creative director would prompt a young person. Yeah. So, and I think I would love to figure out a way to try to educate young people on those skills fast, because I think it'll help save their jobs.
Yeah, totally agree. I mean, 100% agree. I'm just going back to this whole storytelling piece. I feel like that's an element like you're, you know, a kind of a master in storytelling in general. And I'm fascinated by this because, again, we talk about diversity of creativity in different executions as well, and how important storytelling is within that. How important is storytelling for brands in 2025?
It's mission critical.
Yeah.
It's mission critical. And I'll say,
can I ask a dumb question?
Yeah.
Why?
Okay. So I'll tell you what, it's actually never not been. All right. But what happened was it became a buzzword in the mid 2013, 2014, 2015. Yeah. And everybody was using it. And what happened was that it became such a buzzword that everybody got sick of it. Yeah. And then they started saying other buzzwords, you know what I mean? Like content and video and all these things, right?
Yeah.
But all those things were just other buzzwords for shit that we'd already had anyway. So whatever. I think we're at right now, I believe this is the year of storytelling to come back. And I believe it's that case because as we start to see the great middling of everything from AI, the only things that will be different are the way that stories are told on behalf of brands and the way that audiences are engaged. And someone took time to actually sit there and craft a story for you. It's interesting. Every brand right now is telling a story, whether they know it or not. Mm. It's already telling a story. And it will keep telling the same story it's telling, whether it's a story of decline, or it's a story of irrelevance, or it's a story of it's for this certain kind of person, or whatever the story is.
Yeah.
It'll keep telling that story until a brand stops that story and tells a different story.
Yeah.
And that is why it is really critical as the world changes, as audiences change, as growth changes, they will need to keep telling those stories, and they will need to work with experts who are good at really identifying what story to tell and how to tell that story.
Love that. I love that. That makes so much sense. We got time. I want to, if you don't mind, you must, I mean, again, I like asking founders of agencies this, and actually any creative leaders, like, what kind of mistakes and or kind of like failures have you made to get you to this point where you are like this tenacious, very resilient human? that can just come back at it again? Like, have you got any kind of lovely little anecdotes or kind of disaster stories that you could tell and share?
As inspiration
to somebody coming up.
I actually just did a talk for the Cannes Lions community in last week, which was called Stupid Mistakes by Brilliant Leaders. And I collected a couple of them. So this is all very, very top of mind. I think, you know, are you thinking about like as they come up, or are you thinking as they're more senior? Where are you thinking?
Like a pitch kind of disaster story.
Oh my God.
Like something, or it just has, or kind of managing a team where you made a mistake, or like you look back and go, probably could have done that a little bit different. I don't know.
Pitches, I think there's a couple pitches that you, a couple things that you can do. One, if you don't swing big enough, if you don't sell a vision or a dream, then you might as well not even be in the room. And I've done this a bunch of times where I've gotten scared and I've thought too small and it's not great. So I would say swing as hard as you can on the pitch. And be yourself. It's better to not get picked because you're yourself versus to not get picked because you're trying to be somebody else, or to get picked because you try to be somebody else and then you end up being yourself and, you know, it's like, they're like, yeah, they don't like it. You know what I mean? So I think that that's a really important thing. I think as a younger person, I would say really fight for it.
Mm.
Bring your most daring also thinking. And I would say that have conviction in your ideas.
Yeah.
Now that's dangerous advice because some people have too much conviction in their ideas and they're not great ideas or they're not right ideas. So I would say have conviction in your ideas as long as you know that they are strategic, they're on brief, and you know that they are right for that client. Mm. And find ways to sell them. Mm. This is the other thing. We have now, one of the great beauties of AI is that we can prototype in like such a short amount of time. So, and we're all emotional people, including your creative directors, believe it or not, they are emotional people. So make something that gets them to go, oh, I see what you're doing. I have a team right now I'm working with, they're out of studios and they prototype everything. And at the minute I hear them start to talk about something and I'm like, I don't know. And then they play something for me. I'm like, oh my God, that's hilarious. Yeah. I love that. So prototype stuff, use the technology to make something. You'll be happy you did.
That's amazing. Yeah. Is there anything, as we kind of come to an end, is there anything that you'd like to say to listener? Is there anything that you feel like needs to be said
to
the industry right now?
Yeah. I think the industry needs to find its mojo again.
Yeah.
I think the industry needs to find its belief in itself. Mm. You know, we spend so much time like cutting our worth, cutting our value. And it ultimately every time that this has happened, where there's been a race to the bottom, it swings back.
Yeah.
Right. And because ultimately the service that we provide, which is, helping brands have a perspective outside themselves, to know what stories that they need to create in order to engage with audiences, and then creating those stories in an engaging way, no matter what the medium or whatever it is, that's what we do. Mm. That is something that is going to be needed, whether we're doing it in TV or content or holograms or implants or whatever it is, you're going to need that. Brands will need that. So stop trying to just remake or cut down old systems and use the opportunity to create new systems going forward that utilizes the core skills that you have.
Do you feel like that's something that's changed in the last couple of years with all the smaller independent agencies popping up post pandemic as well? Like,
yeah, they're taking a bite and taking a giant chunk out of some of the bigger guys. We go up against bigger agencies all the time.
Yeah.
And I think it doesn't matter. Like a small company that's seven people can win against a big agency. Mm. Because it's the quality of thinking and it's the story that you're telling and it's the dream you're selling. It's the vision you're selling. So keep selling the big dreams.
Keep selling the big dreams
and have big dreams for yourself. Come on, man. You're worth it. You know what I mean? Like, you're worth it. You're nice. Worth it. Like, you know your value and know that you have such, you know, another gift that we have is category experience or experience across tons of categories. And some of us now decades of experience across tons of categories and tons of audiences. So innately in our hearts, we understand things. I'll tell you one more thing. Yeah. I was just listening to a physicist, a podcast with a neuropsychologist and a physicist. Oh. And it was way out of my depth. And I was thinking, oh my God, I cannot believe they're just dropping things that are like these phrases that they know that are so natural. And I'm like, that is crazy.
Like I'm curious.
Big
scary words.
Yeah. I mean, it was basically talking about evolutionary game theory. And yeah, like okay. it was like very much like,
This is what Jamie listens to.
it was a friend sent it to me and I'm like, wow, 3 hours, yeah. 3 hours of, yeah.
Whoa.
But I was there going, holy crap. Like this is crazy. They know this. And I said, you know what though? I bet if they listen to the advertising people talk, I mean, we are not saying words like evolutionary game theory, but I bet they would be like, what are these people talking about?
Yeah.
So own our expertise. We know what we're doing.
Own your expertise.
I want to say that. And I want to say Fridays, if you are looking for an agency or a rap writer, I'm here.
Yeah, 100%. Oh, thank you. Do you want to talk a little bit about like the power of independent agencies? Because I feel like we haven't really touched upon like, you've been an independent agency for a decade.
Yes, yeah. Almost nine years, but almost a decade.
When's it a decade?
Next May. So we started in May of 2016. I started at the end of 2015.
Got it. Because I feel like there's a real shift. I see this from like brands naturally coming, like leaning towards indie agencies because of the autonomy, slightly smaller budgets perhaps compared to the networks, tariffs. I don't know. Like what do you feel like there's a real power for the independent agency at the moment?
I do. I think the power is different than... I think the power is different than I think what some of the headlines will tell you.
Okay, interesting.
I think the power is the power of giving a shit and the power of if I sit down across from a client and I'm going to pitch their business, I am putting my faith in that client that it is worth my time, my money, and my people's time and our agency money, right? And I will not take on a pitch unless I believe in the person that I'm sitting across from.
Yeah.
And that is because there's real serious opportunity cost and their business is fundamentally tied in with ours. So when we have clients, like we will do everything to make our clients perform.
Yeah.
So it's not really about, you know, like will we win at Cannes? It's not like necessarily that. It's like, unless that's a metric that they have at their own business, which some of them are. But it will be like, you know, do I think I can help this person in their business, in their own job? And I think that's something that you get from founders, especially founder-led indies, that you don't have in other places. Because in a very, very real sense, our fortunes are now tied together. So it is like when you're a client and you hire a founder-led agency, you are hiring a true partner whose livelihood and whose life and is. And so I think it's very different, to be honest. And so we don't take on pitches with people that. You know, we don't think we want to go into business with, and we're glad when people say, you know, you weren't right for us. We're going to move on and choose somebody else because it meant that they didn't feel that way. They spared our time too.
Fair. What a lovely way to end on. I really appreciate your time. Thank you.